Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The 2019 legislative session begins January 14th. The upshot of the midterm elections is that Republicans still control the State House, the State Senate, and the Governor's Office. There are several issues, including privatized Medicaid and tax reform, that Republicans and Democrats would like to work on during the session. One of the new faces on the Democratic side will be Sioux City's Jackie Smith, who took the District 7 seat from incumbent Rick Bertrand. Smith says there are several areas she would like to see addressed when the session starts. They range from education to abortion rights to tax reform. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has said she would like to take a second look at tax credits for businesses, and Smith says it's an area that has been too long ignored.
Well, the tax credit program does need to be reviewed. It had risen dramatically over the years. I don't have specific figures in front of me, but the percentage of the budget increased in that area. I don't think in today's corporate world we can completely get rid of them, but certainly we can go through them and pare down the amounts and at the same time do other things in our state to make it attractive for businesses to come, like a great educational system and amenities, good infrastructure and infrastructure ready sites. So I think it's just one piece of an overall approach to economic development. And, you know, I'm glad they are looking at it because it certainly was a topic during the campaign and highly criticized on some of their giveaways.
Also a big issue has been funding education, a lot of concern about schools not being able to fund all their projects and where some of the money might come from. I know that people are talking about extending this 1 cent statewide sales tax for school infrastructure. I know it doesn't expire for a while, but do you think that should be extended?
I think it should be extended. You know, the buildings here in Sioux City are wonderful, the new elementary buildings. And I think that it's important to continue, you know, with the building projects. The high schools, you know, are pretty old, 1973. I know that because I was first graduating class from North High School, and they were new then. So we could look at, you know, updating or maybe even at some point in time in the future, you know, the school board may have plans to even replace. I have no idea, but it's necessary. And I like that it's a designated fund, so we're not taking funds away from classrooms and teachers to fund building projects. So I like it being a separate source of money.
Medicaid privatization probably has been one of the most hotly debated issues ever since that started a few years ago. What do you think should happen, considering all of the problems with getting care? And some Republicans say, well, we should fix parts of it that don't work. But I know some Democrats say we should just go back to the way it was, have a public system.
Well, I, at this point in time, would favor a public system. I never understood how privatizing it would save money in the long run, knowing that companies need to make money. And I was afraid that services would be impaired, of which that has happened. So to bring it back in, I can hardly wait for the new audit with the new auditor to see exactly where we are as far as savings, if there are any. I think that's been greatly exaggerated, it appears. And I know from talking with providers and also families with that are receiving services that, you know, there is just a lag time in getting the services or they've been cut. So that's just unacceptable, I believe, and not a way to save money on the backs of vulnerable people is just not acceptable. So a public option should be looked at again. Will it be exactly the way it is? I don't think usually things never go back to exactly the way they were. So maybe in the process, we can look how to contain the cost, because that's why it was privatized to begin with, is there was a fear that, you know, costs are rising too much. But it's my understanding that, you know, the costs are rising about three times what they were when it was a public system. So it looks to me that public option and bringing it back under maybe DHS or another nonprofit entity like the hospitals, I've heard that floated a little bit too, should be something that should be investigated. And I more than likely will support something along those lines.
There's also a lot of interest in creating a better mental health system in the state, especially for children. But people are concerned about, you know, how are we going to fund this? Should we have an extra tax levy? Should regions, the counties in regions who often oversee this, have their own local levies?
When you do budgeting, it oftentimes is about your priorities as opposed to not having the money. So I'm not sure that the money's not there. They may just be going to business tax credits, for instance. I do think the regions, I was part of setting up our region when I was a county supervisor, certainly has the ability and the knowledge and the skill to partner with the state in the children's mental health improved system and delivery system. And you know, taxing authorities at the local level, you know, are going to have to probably pay for part of that. But then along with that, local control and say-so should be allowed as well.
Do you think there'll be any action this year concerning abortion? I know that in the past there was this idea to put a personhood bill up that would pretty much, you know, prevent most abortions in the state. But it seems like the bill, the law that was passed last year, the 6-week bill, the fetal heartbeat bill, still in the courts, that's tied up. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of momentum to go forward with any other legislation about abortion.
Well, I haven't heard anything, but then I wouldn't be privy to discussions on restricting health care for women and choice for women. I do believe that we need to ramp up women's health care, especially in rural areas. I know that OBGYN services, you know, are not as plentiful as they used to be, and maternal deaths are on the rise, with the lack of having access, such as Planned Parenthood. So, you know, that's one part of the whole women's health issue. So I don't know where it will go. It was an illegal bill to begin with. I'm certainly not going to push anything along that line. What I will be working on is making sure everyone has access to health care, and that's affordable as well.
You say the bill was illegal in terms of the state of Iowa?
Well, that's why it's in the court system.
Right. That's what I thought. Are there any other issues that you're particularly concerned about, or you're thinking, I would like to, you know, do something about that issue?
You know, there are a couple. I still would like to see the state take up a minimum wage raise. You know, here in Woodbury County, we are sitting at approximately 42% of our population either at or right above or below the poverty level. That's one piece of helping that out. So minimum wage, I'd like to see. I would also like to be involved in clean water and environmental issues as well. I think we need to partner with the landowners and the farmers. We could work through drainage districts to come up with some local projects, even for Snyder's Bend or Browns Lake. So clean water, I think, is a big issue as well.
Right.
Funding it. You know, everyone agrees we need it. It's how you fund it, you know, is always the bugaboo. But I believe a long time ago, several years back, it was voted on to fund clean water through a percentage of the sales tax, if I remember right, but that it's never been implemented. It was voted on, but it's never been implemented. So perhaps we need to go back and look at that too. And while that may be hurtful to some populations, anytime you raise the sales tax, maybe, you know, it could be adjusted on the other end with personal income tax or something.
That was newly elected Democratic 7th District State Senator Jackie Smith of Sioux City talking about issues of concern in the upcoming legislative session. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. I also talked this week with a Republican state senator about the upcoming session. Jason Schultz of Schleswig represents the 9th District. Asked about his priorities for the session, Schultz said two of the most important issues have to do with providing health care services.
I would imagine two of our largest issues, and they're fiscal, but not so much in savings, but is looking to improve our MCO, our Medicaid system, and to continue our work on the mental health system. That was that seemed to be one of the biggest messages I received from watching the returns and commercials and polling across the state before the election. So we're going to have to be dealing with those. Meanwhile, we'll have another look at our tax system. We passed a pretty comprehensive major bill last year. But there's always a few tweaks that you discover after a year of the machine, you know, kind of working the new legislation through. So we will be taking a look there. I don't know that we have anything huge to announce there, but you always want to try to improve and make it run smoothly.
Talking about the whole Medicaid privatization issue, a lot of Democrats have told me they would like to see it completely handed back to the state and have it managed, you know, by a public entity. How do you feel about that?
I don't believe we can go back. I don't think there's any intent to go back. And actually, there's a few folks calling for a return that I don't believe are being completely genuine. I think they understand that going back would be a step backwards also. I remind people we had to get away from it because it was the cost increases were absorbing the entire, such a large amount of the budget that we were going to have to start literally cutting K-12 education instead of adding new money to it as we have been. So going back is, I don't believe, an option that's on the table, but 39 states are doing Medicaid through an MCO system, and it seems to be working at various levels. I don't understand why we're having this problem, and I think that's why I think it'll be one of our main priorities.
Last year, Republicans approved the largest state tax relief package in Iowa history. What would you like to do going forward with taxes?
The very first year after something that major, I think it always is. It's always prudent to look first for glitches and any unintended consequences before you expand upon it. But so we'll be taking a look at that, and I would like to continue moving toward a lower tax burden on Iowans, which I believe generally and pretty much every time it's tried. Increases economic activity and increases the prosperity of a region, a state. So I guess I'd like to continue down that road. But first, we have to look and make sure that what we've done is working well.
Speaking of education now, I know some folks, including the Association of Iowa School Boards and others, would like to extend this 1 cent statewide sales tax for infrastructure projects. What do you think? Is that a good idea?
It will happen. I've been reassuring our school boards locally here that it will happen. So I've been trying to tell them they will never lose an annual payment out of that fund. But I do believe that the pressure is going to have to probably go maybe this year, but maybe the year next or the next year. I'm sorry, I got my words backwards. One of the concerns that a lot of folks have, and I share the concern, but I'm ready to go ahead and extend it. But that the reason the school boards are so so strong in their pressure to extend it is so they can start borrowing against it right away. And while they will never, they'll never not receive a payment out of that, we'll extend it before 2029 when it expires. But I think it wouldn't hurt for them to save their dollars, you know, payment after payment, if they need a large project. I'm concerned about public sector borrowing. I guess that's the short of it. So I'm not so concerned about getting it done long before 2029 or 20. It's right at 2030 when it expires. So they're going to see it happen. I just think that they can accept the annual payments and not be so eager to borrow ahead so far.
Is that what they've done in the past?
Well, that seems to be maybe more so the city or the more urban schools than our rural schools, but they also seem to be the districts that seem to be the loudest in this. And I'd like to see them manage the money that they're receiving before they get really excited about borrowing too far into the future.
Governor Reynolds would really like to, she says, do something about improving mental health care in the state of Iowa. And one of the ideas she said she would support would be raising the sales tax to help pay for that, or allowing counties to increase property taxes.
Oh, I got to admit, I cringed a little bit when I heard about increasing sales taxes for this. I can say that I would oppose allowing counties to increase property taxes. Mental health services is a broad-ranged subject and is not directly or even indirectly tied to property ownership. You know, it's not a service that you receive as a property owner. I wouldn't want to expand property taxes for this. This is a service that should be borne by all Iowans. That doesn't mean I'm in favor of increasing the sales tax on this, but I would certainly look at that direction first. Not toward raising taxes, but toward finding money in the general fund or from a broad-based tax source.
Looking at abortion rights, there was a question about whether or not Republicans might put forward what's being called this personhood bill. Though the fetal heartbeat bill is sort of wrapped up in the state courts. And do you think you would go forward with this personhood bill as well?
I won't myself this year. I mean, I can't speak for anyone else who might want to file it. But I believe we've passed the strongest protection bill for babies in the womb in the country. Now, while it's going through the court system, and we knew it would, I mean, it's its own drama and its own chapter that has to be played out in this area. But while that's happening with the heartbeat bill, I don't think it would be wise for me to introduce another bill that would draw attention away from the heartbeat bill and its passage through the courts. So no, it won't be me. I'm gonna step back and work behind the scenes and try to get that thing through the court system, so that we can finally see the day when babies are protected like everybody else.
Have you heard from constituents about the charge that this bill, the fetal heartbeat bill, and also the defunding of Planned Parenthood has led to fewer services, contraception services, women's health services in the state?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, that's sort of
in Senate District 9. It's we are a very strong pro-life a district. We were receiving none of those none of those reported services. You know, we don't have an abortion mill in the district, so we don't have those people, you know, claiming those services here. All those services are eligible or available at hundreds of health centers across the state, you know, through the Medicaid system.
If you did hear there was a shortage of those kinds of services, do you think Republicans would be willing to talk about expanding those services for women in some way?
We already did. As we moved that money away from the abortion industry, we moved it toward out, you know, pro women's health facilities all throughout the state. That was a couple years ago, 3 years ago now, and there's a list of hundreds of pharmacies and clinics that offer pills and women's health services that that are in, well, I believe every county of the state.
I wanted to ask you about IPERS and the continuation of IPERS the way it is now, because I've heard from some Democrats in and around Woodbury County, they're concerned about Republicans having a task force to study the future and shift away from the way that IPERS is handled now. Do you think that would happen?
Oh, some of that is just shameless political posturing, to be quite honest. There is going to be no change to IPERS. That's been stated by every legislative and executive leader in the state, the governor and our caucus leaders. But every pension in the country has an issue of longevity. And I mean, that's just, it's a mathematical issue. And I believe that as sound and solid as Iowa's pension system is, we would not be doing taxpayers or the recipients of IPERS any favors by letting the ball just roll down the field. We should be talking at least fact-finding to find out where we stand and how things are going, and let the people of Iowa know. But because it became a toxic political issue, nothing's going to happen and there won't be any talk about it.
Well, finally,
but I don't think that serves Iowa or the pensioners very well. But that's where we stand.
Okay. Well, finally, I wanted to ask you about this right to bear arms resolution. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about what that would mean? Say if it were passed in, you know, next year or the following year, it would be a constitutional amendment, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it would be a constitutional amendment. Iowa is one of just a few states that do not have protections built into their own state constitution to protect the right to keep and bear arms in various manners, you know, different language in different states. The joint resolution that we will pass again this year and then move on to the people of Iowa for them to examine and to consider, and I expect to pass, would be some of the strongest language for firearm owners to protect them in the state of Iowa from any effort to restrict, to confiscate, to infringe on any of their rights as a citizen of Iowa and a citizen of the United States.
Do you think that having harsher, you know, penalties for possessing guns illegally, do you think that would kind of stop the people having guns when they're not supposed to have guns and leading to the shootings that we've seen? Do you think that would make a difference?
I think that if we would enforce the laws that we have, and that would be, you know, felon possession or people who have disqualified themselves from firearms ownership through whatever means, whether it's breaking the law or criminal history. I think that would go a long way, but a whole lot of what's going on in our culture is not firearms related anyway. It's cultural. The removal of God from our culture, the chemical medication of our children, once again, you know, that's related to the mental health issues. I think there's a lot of other issues that would come on that list ahead of firearms when you're talking about some of these tragedies that happen across the country.
That was Republican State Senator Jason Schultz of Schleswig, who represents the 9th District. I also talked with Sioux City Democratic State Senator Jackie Smith about the upcoming legislative session. It begins January 14th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Efforts to track down and decrease opioid deaths in Iowa have been fairly successful, with a number of deaths down in the state. However, methamphetamine use and deaths are on the rise. Friday is National Methamphetamine Awareness Day. The interim director at Iowa's Office of Drug Control Policy wants people to know how dangerous this drug is. Dale Woolery says meth is now being mostly gotten from out of state and shipped in, often from Mexico. He says the number of Iowans going into drug treatment for meth is at or near an all-time high, and meth-related prison admissions are also up. I asked Woolery to compare the trend of meth use and opioid use in Iowa over the last few years, and also why the number of users of both substances has changed.
It's still a bit of a mixed bag, but for the first time in a few years now, we do have a reason to be encouraged and hopeful, and the work remains to be able to further drive down some of those numbers and still turn some others around on the opioid front.
Do you think that part of the change has to do with doctors being more careful and accountable in how they prescribe opioids?
I do. I think that we're seeing a lot of change, some of it market-driven, I would suggest, meaning healthcare practitioners, insurance companies, hospitals and clinics, changing policies, changing practice, some of it formally, some of it informally. And some of the change, I think it depends on who you talk with as to whether it's viewed as positive or negative. An example would be the reduction in opioid prescribing. The CDC changed its guidelines for doctors and other prescribers about 2 years ago. And I think many healthcare practitioners who do prescribe, that would include dentists and some nurses, I think they've reduced how many opioids they prescribe. I think the numbers here in Iowa reflect that. And I think that we also have some who were prescribing who now no longer prescribe. For those who may be suffering from severe pain and, rely on opioids, that may not be viewed as good news. But for the issue of opioid misuse and all the things that can go wrong along with that, including overdose, I think it's going to reduce that risk. Other things that have changed or happened, I think, that contribute to this would include things like public policy issues involving greater access to naloxone. Naloxone is the opioid overdose reversal medicine that's available by prescription, and Iowa law changed 2 years ago to essentially allow anyone, any first responder and anyone else in a position to assist, to purchase it, possess it, and use it to reverse an overdose and essentially save someone's life. It's a short-term save. It's kind of a pause button. The individual certainly needs emergency medical care after that. But we're seeing more and more naloxone used in the field, and that means more overdoses being reversed, more lives being saved. We've also seen an expansion in medication-assisted treatment options, meaning that more Iowans who perhaps are addicted to or dependent on opioids now have more accessible places to go to get medication-assisted treatment, which is, I think it's fair to say, the number one best preferred treatment process for dealing with those addicted to opioids to get them into recovery, so that they can be functional and not dependent on the the more addictive opioids. We've also seen an expansion in the prescription drug take-back receptacles, both on the one-day events that occur in the spring and the fall each year. But more importantly, I think those that are being set up in law enforcement centers and pharmacies that are available year-round, meaning that Iowans now have more convenient options to get rid of unused prescription opioids and other prescription medications once they no longer are needed, because that's where a lot of the misuse comes from.
What about methamphetamine? I read that the number of meth labs that have been busted is down dramatically, but people are still using meth.
The methamphetamine situation is indeed kind of a bifurcated issue. the part of the methamphetamine, I guess, challenge that got a lot of attention 15 years ago or so was the labs, and deservedly so. They presented a true public safety hazard in the form of fire, explosion, and a lot of unwitting Iowans being at risk in especially apartment buildings and elsewhere. And so the labs got a lot of attention. We had 1,500 in, I think, 2004. In 2018, we are on pace to have fewer than 25. And so we've seen a precipitous and dramatic drop in the prevalence of methamphetamine labs in Iowa, now averaging about two per month statewide, reaching the lowest point in 23 years. So we are almost back to pre-methamphetamine activity levels when it comes to the labs. That's very positive news. However, on the flip side, I think it's fair to say that the cartels in Mexico that manufacture a great deal of methamphetamine are filling some of the void, if not much of the void, because we are seeing more methamphetamine being seized by law enforcement in Iowa, and it's of the more pure form. It's higher in purity, larger in volume, and it's almost all being made in Mexico and then smuggled across the border into the U.S. and ultimately into Iowa for use by Iowans. And the result from that, in part anyway, is that we have more Iowans who are going into substance use disorder treatment for methamphetamine. In fact, among adult Iowans last year, we had more citing meth as their primary drug than marijuana. 23% of those in treatment, publicly funded treatment, said methamphetamine was their primary substance. And then also something that now is being tracked as we track opioid-related overdose deaths. We have psychostimulant-related deaths in Iowa, and we had 96 of those in 2017, which is the highest point of the most recent 5 years of record-keeping. And it's frankly something I'm not sure we were paying close attention to before opioids came along with the misuse problem. And now, as we track psychostimulant-related deaths in Iowa, we see a lot of Iowans and a lot of Iowa families impacted by those. And chief among the psychostimulants, which is a broader category, is methamphetamine. It would be the leading stimulant in that group when it comes to those deaths. So methamphetamine never really went away. The addiction problem never left. It's a highly addictive substance. The use of meth has remained strong in Iowa, even when the labs fell off. I think arguably now it's more in demand perhaps than ever. And the supply is, it's being supplied, I should say, by those who make it out of state and send it in as a matter of profit.
Would Adderall and all other drugs for ADD be considered psychostimulants as well?
So you'd have Adderall, Ritalin, any prescription stimulant, I think would qualify, as I understand it, as a psychostimulant. And there would be some others, too. I just know that anecdotally, in speaking with our state medical examiner, Dr. Klein, his take on this, based on autopsies they've done at the state medical examiner's office, when it comes to psychostimulant-related deaths, it appears that the great majority of those involved methamphetamine. That's not to say that there weren't others that did involve some of these other types, or that there weren't combinations of drugs in some of those who died. But meth appears to be the big driver, as it is with drug-related prison admissions for different reasons. But sometimes we can look at the data and at least get an indication, even if it's not, even if you can't say it's exclusively the case, we get an indication of, you know, what's predominantly, I think, impacting some of that. And methamphetamine, there is a lot of it being used, and it's I guess, highly subject to abuse. And I think we're seeing that in treatment admissions, in psychostimulant-related deaths, and in other ways, whether it's child endangerment or if it's prison admissions. It's impacting a lot of families, and it's impacting a lot of Iowans generally. We certainly need to do more. We need to continue to prevent young people from using meth or any other addictive substance, because the earlier you start using, the more problematic it can be. But then if you have individuals who begin to use, or in the case of prescription opioids, misuse, and start down that path of addiction, we need to ensure that they get referred to treatment and connected, and that they either go or are somehow introduced to treatment, because while treatment will not work for everyone every time, first time, it does work. Relapse is part of it for some, but we know that Iowans who do go into treatment, many of them, when they're done with treatment, come out and are able to be employed. They stay drug-free, and they stay free of arrest. So we know that when it comes to having Iowans who can function and function legally as citizens and good family members, healthy family members, treatment is, it's probably the best option for those who would be otherwise continuing their addiction. And I should mention that coming up at the end of this week, November 30th, is National Methamphetamine Awareness Day. I see the Iowa Department of Public Health is trying to promote that, reminding Iowans that if anyone in their family needs help, you can locate a local treatment provider from the statewide network by going to the website yourlifeiowa.org.
I guess my last question, and it might be something I just need to look up somewhere. Do we know, sort of looking around the state, is there any one area of the state that is, especially, using a lot of meth or using a lot of opioids? I imagine there's something probably online where I can look this up.
We have in the past tracked or tried to track the meth labs, but again, they're so few in number now, thankfully. Where they do exist, those meth labs tend to be a little more, I think, in eastern Iowa, and to some extent, maybe central Iowa, southwest, northwest. But again, those are fairly few in number. I mean, what I have seen in the past, but not recently, on treatment admissions, I think it, of course, the population centers tend to have larger numbers, and you have larger numbers of people going into treatment. I mean, it's kind of what you would expect. But as far as looking for anomalies and any patterns, I don't know that those exist in any form that I've seen recently anyway. Drug addiction is an equal opportunity disease.
That was Dale Woolery, the interim director of the Governor's Office on Drug Control Policy. He says meth use is on the rise in Iowa, and he's trying to raise awareness about its dangers. Friday is National Methamphetamine Awareness Day across the country. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Since the 1990s, welfare reform has changed the way benefits are allocated in the United States. Limitations on benefits and work requirements have been popular changes, but a new book argues these requirements tend to affect women and people of color disproportionately. Felicia Kornbluth and Gwendolyn Pink are the authors of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in the Feminist Perspective. The authors discuss arguments advanced by feminists for a welfare policy that would respect single mothers' rights while advancing their opportunities and assuring economic benefits for their families. Kornbluth details in the book The Path of Welfare Reform back in 1994.
1994 was when the Republicans took both houses of Congress for the first time in something like 35 years, right? And they ran on what they called a contract with America that promised some positive things for middle-class Americans, and also promised a new get-tough approach to poor people and to public benefits. And then it did take about 2 years, and in August 1996, that Republican Congress passed, and then President Bill Clinton signed this law that really changed our approach to taking care especially of mothers with young children who are in economic trouble. In the old days, we were never super generous as a society or as a government, but we did at least promise people that if they met certain eligibility criteria, that they would be assured that they would get some help, right? So if a woman was being abused by a boyfriend or a husband, for example, and trying to raise young kids and trying to think about whether she could get out of that situation, there was a governmental assurance that there would be some assistance there. And after 1996, it was no longer an assurance, or what we used to call an entitlement to aid. And what's more, we said, even in the best case scenario, the government would only give people 5 years maximum of assistance throughout their whole lives. So let's say you have two kids, right? And you're starting at the point when they're born and you're raising them on your own and your economic situation is really fragile. You're not going to be able to get two kids into full-time, full-day schooling in 5 years, right? And, you know, and that's just assuming that it's only one time in your life when you need help. I mean, let's say you get into trouble again some other time in your life because of a bad relationship or an illness or some other issue. So that was what really changed. It went from being a kind of minimal, not really adequate promise that we made to people to being no promise at all. And that's had really big effects on women and children.
So what kind of effects are we talking about? Are we talking about being poorer, basically being unable to buy enough food without, you know, SNAP, without food stamps, those kinds of things?
Yeah, well, at the big picture, if you look at statistics, you see people really dividing into two groups. So some people have done a little bit better in terms of dollars because they're in the labor market and the government has made available to them an earned income tax credit, EITC. And if you have pretty low wages, you can still file your taxes at the end of the year and get a financial supplement. And that might raise you over the poverty line, right? So those people are doing a little bit better economically. But what we look for there, the troubling thing or the concerning thing, is that a lot of those folks are in very, very stressed out families. Like those are folks who are working more than one job, maybe. Those are folks who, you know, whose childcare situation may be very precarious, right? So there, in terms of dollars, people might be doing even a little bit better than they did before 1996, but we're looking at very high levels of family stress and kind of precariousness, because the whole apple cart could fall over. And then we have this other group of people, maybe a third of the people who are not really attached to the labor market, who are not getting those earned income tax credits because they don't know about them because they don't have enough private sector earnings to qualify. And those people seem to have just like had the bottom pulled out from under them. Those are people who are much poorer than they would have been before the 1990s. And we only have a little bit of evidence about what people are actually doing to sustain themselves. But we know that folks are engaging in some illegal activities in order to hold body and soul together. People are like selling their blood plasma at blood labs. I'm sure that there are women who are prostituting themselves and women who are staying with abusive men in order to keep their own and their kids' fortunes afloat. You know, so that's the kind of situation we're dealing with.
Have you noticed that people that maybe we wouldn't have thought of to have these problems in the past, maybe, families with one parent or people, but people that have jobs, people that have been thought of as, you know, working people, have a job, have a home, with the basically salaries not really advancing and inflation going up, I would think this really impacts women particularly hard if they're single mothers, because having a child, if your child is sick and you're in a situation where you can't take a day off, that's like a huge disaster.
I think that as a society, for some reasons, we are asking people to make these really drastic choices all the time, right? Take care of my kid who's sick at home or keep my job. You know, go to that appointment that might be necessary for maintaining my health insurance, my Medicaid health insurance. You know, I might have to go to an appointment or keep my job. Go to school to help my kid get through a tough time at school or participate in PTA or something like that. You know, those are the things that families at the economic margins really aren't able to do. And more, if we say to folks, look, the only thing that counts is how you participate in the waged labor market, how you participate in what we conventionally call work, then I think we force people into those kinds of situations. And basically, we force people to neglect their kids.
Applying for some kind of assistance, which is hard for people in the first place, but especially, you know, temporary assistance for needy families. They had a conference up north of here last winter talking about the difficulties of getting that assistance at all. And I had no idea that they had so many hurdles.
It's always been true that as a society, as a government, we don't want to make it easy for people to get economic help. But it's just gotten much, much harder, to the point where most people don't even know the program exists. They don't even apply. And the thing that's really been lost, I think, is the idea that people could get cash assistance and that's okay. You know, it's morally okay. It's politically okay. It can be necessary, even positive for a family, to get some additional cash. And I think that whole idea, which was very much of an idea of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, that like this is what we just do as a modern society, right? We help people in times of economic distress. And sure, we give them cash because that's the most useful thing. It's the most malleable thing you can have. But since the 1990s, that whole idea has dropped out. So we will give people a little bit of assistance with which to get food through food stamps or the SNAP program. But we won't give people cash, for the most part, cash that they can just spend on their own families, you know, and make their own decisions about that.
That was Felicia Kornbluth, one of the authors, along with Gwendolyn Pink, of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in the Feminist Perspective. And that is The Exchange for this week here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.